I've been hearing stories already about what's been going on here as you've used the new premises for different kinds of outreach and impacting different people's lives. And it was funny even watching the video last night of all the things going on in the church. And the three W's, that the women's thing. And every picture was like sitting around these like huge cake stands with food and all the rest. And I thought, well, it's not Weight Watchers anyway. So plenty of fun going on there. Great. I'm just wanting to check. I see you have a countdown at the start for when the service is starting. I just want to check there's not one for when the sermon finishes. But it's super. But I want to ask you a question as you think about what's going on here. Here's my question. Who's in charge? Now, I know the answer in Hamlet Baptist is Raymond Pitt, because he's in charge of everything. Has been forever. But asking it seriously, who's in charge? Who's pulling the strings? Who's setting the agenda for what's going on around here? And I don't mean who's first on the list of key holders that the police will ring in the middle of the night when something goes wrong. Something way more important than that. Who's in charge? And as you ponder that, let me take you to a couple of episodes in the New Testament. They aren't about a building as such, but they are very much, they very much tell us something about who's in charge. And the first one is in Luke chapter 5. Two very similar episodes, actually. And we're going to read them both, because whilst they're similar, there is a bit of a difference in them as well that I want to mention in passing before we answer this who's in charge question. But it's at the start of Luke chapter 5. We'll just read the first few verses, and then we're going to jump over to John chapter 21 after we do this one. One day, as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, the people were crowding around him and listening to the word of God. He saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little from shore. Then he sat down and taught the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything. But because you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man." And then jumping over into John chapter 21, after the resurrection and everything that has happened around Jerusalem those few days, at the start of the chapter, we read that afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them. And they said, "Well, we'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. We will go on to answer this question, who's in charge, but just before we do, one of the most striking features about the Bible is its honesty. And especially its honesty about some of its heroes. Because woven through the pages of the Bible are a string of examples of people who made terrible mistakes and awful choices. Immorality, dishonesty, betrayal, anger, violence. And people who had to confront their failures and their need of forgiveness. And for me, that adds to the authenticity of the Bible. Because let's face it, if you were going to make up your holy book to show how great your religion was, would so many of your top people make as many mistakes as we have recorded for us in the Bible? There's a great integrity and honesty inside there. And I particularly love the example of Peter. You know, he just comes across as this larger than life character. You know that saying we have here that he only opened his mouth to change feet? And he was a bit like that. So many highs, so many lows, and they're all painted there for us. And these two episodes about Peter, both times we confront these situations where Peter and his colleagues have fished all night with no success, and then Jesus appeared and suggested they try again, and amazingly, in response to Jesus, they filled their nets. But there's one big difference between the two stories. Did you notice what happened the first time? Did you notice what Peter's response was the first time that it happened? He told Jesus to go away. He was just so awestruck with who Jesus was and what had happened. And there was such a realization of his own weakness. He just basically said, "You're way too holy. I can't be near you. You have to go away. I'm just too evil." But the second time that it happened, and remember that this is just after Peter has really messed up, when he cursed and swore and denied that he even knew Jesus. Did you notice what happened this time? Instead of telling Jesus to go away, Peter jumped out of the boat and legged it to the shore to get to Jesus. Complete turnaround from "go away from me" to "I can't get to you quickly enough." So what has changed? Was Jesus not holy anymore? Well, that's definitely not true. Was Peter not sinful anymore? That was definitely not true, because Peter was painfully aware of how sinful he was. So what's the difference? Well, do you know what I think? I think the difference is that Peter has now spent enough time with Jesus and has seen enough of Jesus to realize that the only place you can go when you have failed is to Jesus. That's actually the very heart of the message of the gospel. It's not that Christians are better than everyone else. Christianity actually is only for people who realize that they're not better than everybody else. It's only for people who know that they've messed up and who know that the only place they can take their mess is to Jesus. I mean, here we are this morning, sat in this beautiful new building, enjoying a great weekend last night, tonight. The other things have been going on this week were all turned out very nicely. There's an air of celebration. And the likelihood is we're actually all putting on a really great show for each other. In some way or another, we're playing out a performance that's covering over some other stuff that we're not too keen to share. Struggles, doubts, situations that we've got ourselves into that are entangling us, messes that we've created and we don't know what to do with them. And it may even be that some of us are sat here thinking that when it comes to our relationship with God, it's a distant memory. Oh, sure, we can go through the motions and we can put on a show with the best of them, but inside we're empty and we're far away, and worse, we actually might even have convinced ourselves that there's no way back. We're damaged goods. We're beyond usefulness. God couldn't forgive us again. You know, that is such a lie. That is a satanic lie. It is exactly what the dark one wants us to think. He would do anything to have us thinking that we are no longer of any use to God. That's one of his core strategies. We got to get away from it. You know, sometimes I think that subconsciously that we buy into the story that you make a journey to the cross once and you're ready for heaven, and then you pretty much hang around or hang on as best you can, waiting for the train to depart, but praying it won't be for a while yet. When actually, the reality of broken people is that a journey to the cross is something we need to keep on making, time after time. Peter may not have had all the theology sorted out in that John 21 story, but he had seen enough of Jesus to know that after he had messed up, the only place he could go with his mess was to Jesus. And we need to remember the same. And maybe some of us need to make that journey right here, right now, and take that mess to Jesus and know his forgiveness and his love. And his recommissioning the same way as he would do with Peter in the rest of John 21. But I want to move on, because there is another side to those stories I want us to think about. And this time it's not where they are different, but it's where they are the same. And it gets us back to my first question about who's in charge. Because these experienced fishermen have worked hard all night, but they've got nowhere. And no fish meant no money, because that was their livelihood. And then along comes Jesus and tells them to try again. And initially, Luke 5 story, you just get the impression they're a little bit ticked off with Jesus coming and telling them to do this. You know, what does a carpenter know about fishing? We know this lake inside out. What do you know? But at least they had the grace to obey, and it kind of was Peter that said, well, because you say so. Do you know how many of us who are parents of teenagers have heard that response? I'm only doing this because you said. And it's a bit like that with Peter. Because you say so, okay, we'll give it a go. And the result was spectacular. So much so that in that later episode, something triggers in them. They're not quite sure that it's Jesus, but something in them triggers, and straight away they do it. But it's bound to have been confusing for them. They had worked hard. They'd given it everything. Fishing all night is no fun. They knew what they were doing. They were the experts. So why had they had no success? Why was it not working? Why was it only as they responded to the prompting of Jesus that it changed? How does that work? And I guess that's a question that we need to ask ourselves much more often. And maybe particularly in our efforts at ministry. We're all of us here probably involved in loads of things. In our families, in our work, in our relationships, our businesses, and our ministries. But tell me, when it comes to all of those situations, what are we relying on most? Is it our hard work, our commitment, and our expertise? Or are we doing what we do in response to the prompting of Jesus? Now, of course, we should work to the very best of our ability. Look at the story of Nehemiah. Nobody worked harder than he did, but nobody relied on God as much as he did either. We got to work hard. We should be growing in our knowledge and our expertise. But if that's the sum total of what we have to offer, then all we will have to show for it will be what our cleverness can muster. And that might be okay in human terms, but surely we're looking for spiritual results. And that's the crunch. Because too often we rely on human efforts to try and produce spiritual results. And that's completely impossible. That's just never going to work. I'm going to be quite personal as I apply this, because this lesson has become increasingly relevant to me and to our ministry this year. Earlier on this year, we were working towards a special week of fundraising for our Chinese Bible distribution. This is a key ministry. I'd love to tell you more about it, but but I don't have time. And we've been trying to inspire folk around the UK in particular to get behind this ministry, to put Bibles into the hands of Chinese people, especially as they come abroad as tourists. And the seeds of an idea were sown at our board meeting. And as usual, see, boards drive you to distraction, because the board members come to a board meeting, come off with a great idea, and then guess who has to carry it out? And then they ask at the next board meeting, well, how did that go? Our board's not quite as bad as that, actually. But the seeds were sown and we started to explore it. And the idea was to have 3 golf days in different parts of the UK at really nice places, and to invite Philip Yancey, who's a good friend of Biblica, to come and speak at them. And the temptation was, Philip's a really keen golfer. He's not a very good one, but he's very keen. And so we started to explore this. Philip was free at exactly the right time in a very hectic schedule. We picked some golf courses and there were all kinds of problems. We thought we weren't going to get them. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, the path just was smoothed. And they were all available on exactly the days that we needed. We then ended up, I got a phone call. I was walking in the streets of London one day and I got a phone call from one of our board members who said that we had a donor who knew virtually nothing about Biblica but really liked the idea and was sending us a check basically to underwrite most of the cost of inviting people to these days. So we were able to invite 50 people to these 3 golf days. We took on a huge faith goal to try and raise £150,000, because that would give us 75,000 Bibles to give to Chinese folk. Got a willing team of volunteers together who were excited about it, starting to recruit guests, or at least trying to, and that's where the whole thing went totally wonky. Because despite all the contacts we had, we got nowhere. And we were trying everything and nothing seemed to work. Everybody we shared it with thought, this is a fantastic idea, I can't come. This is a brilliant idea, I don't play golf. That's a wonderful idea, I wouldn't be interested. And I could be honest with you, I really started to panic. Because when you book those places, you gotta pay. There's no such thing as 3 days before ringing up and saying, you know what, we're not gonna do this anymore. They don't work like that. And actually, by early April, it had got to the stage where I couldn't sleep. And I mean, I really couldn't sleep. I was awake every night worrying by early April. And I just couldn't get it out of my head. Alongside of that, I started going through a journey on my own through the second part of Community Bible Experience. I know you guys have done the New Testament here in Hamilton Road. Well, the second part is the Covenant History Books, the early part, really, the history of the Old Testament. And now that's a serious business. The New Testament was easy. From Genesis through to the end of Kings, that's a whole different ballgame, especially the day where you have 18 pages of Deuteronomy to read all in the one day. I call it big boy Bible reading, and it's dead serious. But it was fascinating for me to be reading this. And one day that journey took on an extra significance. I was reading in Numbers chapter 20. The Israelites were complaining again, so much so actually that Moses lost his cool. And Moses really blew it. Remember when God told him to bring the people around the rock? And Moses brought them around the rock. And then in his anger, he smashed the rock just in sheer frustration. And God spoke these really chilling words to Moses. Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. That verse became imprinted on my mind. God's words to his people through that journey so often were in the whole story of the Exodus. Look back at how I have brought you this far. Look at what I have provided for you. Surely you can trust me for the rest of the journey. And whilst so many aspects of the Old Testament law and the rituals may not apply to us today, I'm pretty sure that we can't wriggle out of the implications of this one. Look how I have led you up until now. Look at the provision I have made. Are you going to stop trusting me now? Directly to you, Kiev? Are you looking back at how I smoothed the way to get this initiative to this point? Are you going to stop trusting me now? All of a sudden with what I've done, and you've acknowledged that it was my doing, is it now all down to what you can deliver? Are you not going to trust me enough to honor me as holy? For if you don't, you will not see the future that I have planned. I remember exactly where I was when I read that. I was sitting in Bob and Bert's coffee shop on the prom in Port Stewart. And I went to the bit where I could get Wi-Fi connection on my iPad and sent an email that day to the rest of the team to tell them what I had heard from God and to challenge them all to make this a spiritual commitment for the next stage. And I decided there and then to go on a 40-day particular spiritual discipline for myself. And I hadn't worked it out, but actually, as it turned out, the 40 days finished the day before Philip Yancey did his first engagement with us. I wasn't to know that at the time. And from that day on, that effort became one of complete dependence. Yeah, we were committed to do whatever we could do, but we did it in absolute reliance on God, and in the liberating knowledge that the results were his problem, because that's the really good bit. When it's God's doing, all the pressure is off, because the success or failure of it is not down to you. It's his work. And basically, we stopped fishing our way, and in response to his command, we put our nets down on the other side. The first thing that happened, I kid you not, I slept like a baby every night afterwards. Now, I still woke up every night because I'm a man of a certain age. But every time I woke up, I went straight back to sleep again. I wasn't able to think about the events even if I tried. And I couldn't help thinking of those words of Jesus. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And I can't begin to tell you the difference that it made. We had such an incredible peace from God, and we really did get to the stage where the burden was light because we had realized it wasn't our burden anymore. And as it played itself out, here's what happened. We filled our first day, that was the Friday. We were over in London doing stuff on the Saturday and then taking services all day on the Sunday. And I was walking back from the church on the Sunday night and I got a phone call to tell me that all the places for Monday were filled. And then later on that night I got some emails that told me that all the places for Tuesday were filled. So much so that on the Friday, which was Royal Port Rush, I didn't even get to play. Grr. And on the Tuesday in Glen Eagles, I also didn't get to play. So God answered our prayers way more than I really wanted him to. But it was just amazing. Donations so far have trebled what it cost us to do the whole thing. We're still a long way from our target, mind you. But more people are sharing the story. Biblica has new ambassadors. Some non-Christians were invited to those days, and they had an opportunity to hear stories about what God was doing and be challenged, and some of them wanted to carry those conversations on. Conversations were had at airports and in airplanes where we ended up praying for people. And it was almost as if God was saying, you know what? You had this really small agenda, but I had this really big agenda. And when you opened it up to me, it was my agenda that was being followed. It wasn't yours. Now, I don't tell you that to say how great we were, because actually the story is about how awful we were and how particularly awful I was. But I share it with you to give thanks to God for what he taught us. And I share it also because I'm guessing that in this congregation there are a lot of tired people carrying a lot of burdens. Burdens of ministry. Burdens in families. Burdens with your health. Burdens with finances. Burdens with relationships. Burdens in your business. And there are insidious forces at work inside of us that seduce us going down the wrong pathways. Pathways where we think it's all about what we have to do. That it really means we got to just work harder. We got to suck it up. We got to be better. And we become dependent on our skills. And we may pay lip service to doing it all in complete dependence and trust. But actually we know that's not the case. In fact, the truth often is that faith in what God wants to do is often the last resort. And we ask God for help when we've exhausted everything else that we can throw at it. Meantime, I guess the Lord watches us stressing and straining and driving ourselves crazy, fishing in the wrong places, the wrong way, wishing that we would stop and listen and do it at his prompting. Now, I am totally sure that you didn't build this building just for the sake of it. That you didn't do this just to spend a couple of hours here on a Sunday. I'm pretty sure that you bought into a vision of what you believed God was calling you to be as a church and how he wanted you to use this place to stay in this location on the street front. But let me tell you, that vision that you bought into will go nowhere if it's not done in complete trust in what God wants you to do. If all you will offer up is your skill and your expertise and your passion, then all you will achieve is what your skill and your expertise and your passion can achieve. Like the little boy with 5 rolls and 2 fish, if it had been left to what he could achieve, he'd have fed 1 person. But when the reliance is on what God can do with what you give him, then a whole different reality kicks in, a spiritual reality. From a biblical perspective, encouraging people to support Bibles for China, that's a spiritual need. That can't be met with anything other than spiritual resources. Seeing the vision of Hamilton Road Baptist Church fulfilled and funded, that's a spiritual need. It can only be met with spiritual power. Seeing your business thrive and seeing lives being impacted through it way beyond more than just doing a good job, that's a spiritual need. It needs spiritual power. Seeing those church situations that are eating you away inside transformed, spiritual need, can only be met with spiritual power. Seeing your ministry advance, spiritual need, spiritual power. Seeing those relationships healed, spiritual need, can only be met with spiritual power. I often find myself reading those strange characters in the last third of the Old Testament. You know, the minor prophets that you can never find. I love reading them. Strange men, but men so in touch with God, and passing on his message. And a while ago, I was reading through the prophet Zechariah. Can't believe how long it took me to realize that Zechariah in the Old Testament was nothing to do with Zechariah in the New Testament. Hundreds of years before, chapter 5 in Zechariah, I was reading these words. I looked again, and there before me was a flying scroll. He asked me, "What do you see?" I answered, "I see a flying scroll, 20 cubits long and 10 cubits wide." And he said to me, "This is the curse that is going out over the whole land. For according to what it says on one side, every thief will be banished. And according to what it says on the other, everyone who swears falsely will be banished. The Lord Almighty declares, I will send it out, and it will enter the house of the thief. And get this, the house of anyone who swears falsely by my name. It will remain in that house and destroy it completely, both its timbers and its stones. That notion of swearing falsely by God's name. Do you know, I think we grew up with a very poor notion of what that meant. That means if someone said, oh my God, they were swearing falsely by God's name. Oh no. Way, way more than that. Way, way more. Basically, when you put it in the context there, it means adding God's name in some way to what is purely your own effort. And getting on with stuff without really following him. It's almost as if we've done everything, we've made all the decisions, we've done all the work. Oh, someone better pray just before we finish. That's what swearing falsely by the name of God means. Tagging his name onto it in some little spiritual platitude as if that makes it okay. And the prophet Zechariah was passing on a really stern warning. He said, if that's what you do, the whole thing will end up as a pile of rubble. Whether that's my life, your business, your church, your ministry. Done purely our way, it has no future. Whereas two chapters earlier, Zechariah had given them the secret of success. Change. Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord Almighty. Or, unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. I wouldn't mind betting that that verse was quoted several times before you started this work as a building. I'm sure it was. And yet, you know, the fabric of the building is no big deal. It's just a means to an end. It's a facility to help you carry out God's real vision for the church. Marie Lacey was brilliant last night, but she called it the sanctuary. This isn't the sanctuary. We use that word, but theologically, that's not right. The sanctuary is us. I've been reading this week in John's Gospel how Jesus changed the whole thing. John chapter 2, when he cleared out the money changers, and he quoted that bit where it says, a zeal for your house will consume me. It wasn't a zeal for the fabric of the building. It was a zeal for the true house of God, the people of God, the temple of God, where God dwells by his Spirit. But time and time again, that imagery of a building is used in Scripture, with the physical picture pointing to a much greater reality in our lives. And the reminder that unless God is in charge, unless God is pulling the strings, we are wasting our time. Unless all we do is in response to him, responding in faith to his lead, to his prompting, all we will get is what our efforts can achieve. And that ain't much. We need to stop paying lip service to faith and truly exercise it. To let our nets down on the other side. And to fish only in response to the command of Jesus.